Professor Allen's Comics Reading Journal for the month of November, 2016. Welcome to the 18th episode of this podcast series. The concept of this show is to just have a brief chat about what comics I read since the last time we had a brief chat about the comics I read. Which pretty much makes this the books I read during November. These books are listed weekly in blog posts at eyesandearsblog.blogspot.com, and I regularly repost those on my Facebook and Twitter, so you can find those lists. But those posts are not exactly spoilers for the podcast, since those are just lists. And here's a little more review, a little more critique, a little more discussion. But first, a little feedback on last month's episode. And I have to start by giving some shout-outs to my fellow podcasters who made up the adoring Latverian crowd from last episode. Ryan Daly went above and beyond, giving me a range of vaguely Eastern European accents, as well as what ended up as the end-of-show clip. Other contributors included Kyle Benning, Chris Franklin, Terrence O'Neill, Aaron Headmoss, and Rob Kelly. If I missed anybody, thank you as well. The clips I got were terrific, and I think we ended up with a pretty decent representation of joyous Latverians. Thanks, all. Now, one of the books I mentioned enjoying last month was The Paybacks, which I lamented was canceled after only, I think it was 4 issues. Iowa's Joe Crawford replied to report that The Paybacks was indeed picked up for more issues by Heavy Metal. It looks like 3 new issues have recently come out. I heard from Ed Moore from Teal Productions and the Comic Book Noise feed, where he hosts or co-hosts a bunch of shows, including, but not limited to, The Mighty Thorcast and Lords of Order, a Dr. Fate fan podcast. You remember that last month I raved about the book Daymen, about humans who work for the great vampire families of the world? Well, Ed agrees that that is a great book. Daymen is one of my top 5 books put out by Boom Studios. Agreed, that was just a great find. After listening to last episode, Clinton Robison of the Coffee and Comics blog suggested that I read a comic full of nothing but cute, fluffy bunnies to balance out all of the horror books on last episode. Spoilers, but there are some more horror-tinged or horror-adjacent books that I'll be talking about this episode. Be warned. But there are also plenty of books to balance that out. Thank you, Clinton. That is very good advice to balance these things out. Michael Laughlin reported that I can't stop my amalgam deep dive until I've read Spider-Boy Team-Up number 1. As he says, it's the amalgamist of all the amalgam books. Well, we'll see about that. Over the past few episodes, I've pointed out the generosity of various listeners who've sent comics my way over the last year or two. And there's more about that coming up in this episode. About that, the lovely and generous Ruth and Darren Sutherland commented, listening to the Comics Reading Journal from Professor Allen, and it warms my heart to be part of a community that includes generous friends like Dr. Ange and Joe Crawford. That led to a bunch of tweets about how many people in this community have sent comics and other gifts to various other members of this community. There have been loads of examples over the years of what I refer to as the comic book circle of life. As a Thanksgiving tweet, I sort of rephrased that, posting a similar comment that got, again, many positive comments. As the Sutherland said, this is a really great community, and I'm privileged to be a part of it. And now, on to the books I read last month. As I do on this show, I categorize the books that I read, and I start with issues I read specifically for podcast appearances, the homework books. And there actually aren't all that much. It's just that super secret project that I have coming way down the road. For that, I read New Gods 7 and 8, New Mutants 58, Necromancer 4 and 6, and Catalyst, Agents of Change number 5. And there was one podcast-related or podcast-adjacent book to listen along with the aforementioned Sutherlands on their Xenozoic Xenophiles podcast, episode 6 to be precise. I read from the collection Xenozoic, pages 154 to 175. Good comic book, excellent podcast. On to the new comics that we read right off the shelves. These are all from DC. Here in the midst of the Rebirth era, Emily and I, as I've said before, will almost certainly talk about Rebirth in detail on an upcoming Short Box Showcase. So I'll try not to do too much detail or too much spoiling, but there's going to be a little bit. Wonder Woman 9 and 10. In the current day, Wonder Woman and Etta and Steve meet with director Sacha Bordeaux to submit their reports. Diana and the restored Dr. Minerva go clothes shopping, and Diana draws quite a crowd at the mall, and she and Steve go out on a date. Back in year one, Diane heads out with Steve and Etta and Dr. Minerva for her first visit to the great American invention, the mall. And of course, terrorists strike, and Wonder Woman learns exactly what some of those gifts are that her patrons bestowed upon her last month. There's a funny scene where nobody knows exactly what the lasso does, so they all grab hold and start telling the truth. Green Arrow 10 and 11, the team had gotten off the very crowded abandoned island and landed themselves on the maiden voyage of the Trans-Pacific Railway, running under the Pacific from Shanghai to Seattle. This event represents worldwide cooperation with political and financial and spiritual leaders from all over the world coming together in harmony. And surprise! Guess what? Terrorists attack! I know. Who could have seen that coming? And maybe the terrorists that were hired to attack the train were hired by Queen Industries? It was kind of a cool closed room mystery, in that it's pretty tough to get off of an underwater train. So cool setting, and a couple of pretty good issues. DC Bombshells 19. This one takes us out of Europe, bringing us back to Gotham and back to the Batgirls. No spoilers, so I'll just say it was another solid issue. The ladies going up against the Reaver. Actually, not just the ladies, but the girls and their buddy Harvey Dent, who, towards the end of the issue, has a very predictable accident. Because no matter the continuity, Harvey Dent always has the same predictable accident. And on to the regular reading that I did. Direct from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics comes Eclipso 18. I bought it because the cover promises Eclipso versus Spectre action. And it did deliver that. There's always the risk that picking up a random book in the middle of a series will leave you totally confused, not knowing what's happened before or what's going to happen next. And this one does start in the middle of a conflict, but that conflict is explained pretty quickly, and we end up with a pretty great throwdown. In this version of continuity, Eclipso was the original Spirit of Vengeance, and God replaced him with the Spectre, because Eclipso was just a little too judgmental in his judgment-ing. And this issue, Eclipso 18, had the great advantage of being the last issue in the run, so I was fortunate enough to not only stumble upon an issue that had the Spectre in it, I also picked one that wrapped up its story. And it did so with a very solid story. Very pleased with this sort of pretty random selection out of the cheap bins. If I'd known it was going to be this good, I would have put it in the quarter bin database instead of just reading it. But I couldn't resist. Kazar the Savage, number 5. I've had this in my stack for a while. I mentioned that because last month's episode included a Kazar story, and I made the pithy comment that I don't ever need to read another Kazar story. Except this one had worked its way up to the top of the stack. So here we are. This one is basically the origin story of Zabu the Sabertoothed Tiger. Not a bad story, actually, except not enough Shanna the She-Devil. She was not the primary lead character in the story, so unfortunately, Mark Sweeney will probably never cover it on Shanna Showcase, his show about Shanna, which is part of the I'm the Gun podcast feed. Steel, number 5. This is from the original late 70s run. Again, this is the end of the run, as the title imploded after this issue. This was an extra length issue, and I suspect that this is because they wanted to wrap the story up. Either they knew for sure that they were being canceled, or maybe they just suspected it. Either way, this does come to an ending. The villain is vanquished. It was a satisfying ending, almost a happy ending. I've had this issue for a few months, and I think it was the great Kenzen Greg Arujo who sent this one to me earlier in the year. I mentioned before the nice care package I got a few months back from Dr. Ange. As you well know, Dr. Ange is a Major League Supergirl fan from way back, and much of the care package featured books featuring the Maid of Might, including Adventures of Supergirl 4. This is the current series that's based on the TV show. And first things first, the likenesses are pretty good, especially Alex, but Supergirl as well. This is part of the first arc, where Supergirl and the DEO are taking on various aliens from Fort Ross. But this is not stories from the show, just taking place concurrently with the show, I suppose. It's a delicate balance, but Sterling Gates is a solid professional writer, and he pulls it off really well. This was a fun issue, just part of a larger story, and after reading this, if I see the first trade in the library sometime or on Hoopla, I think I'd pick it up. It did make me want to read more of the story, more of the title. And all us Middletons are huge fans of the TV show. So stories set in that universe seem pretty appealing. Ange's packet included the crossover issue Superman Gen 13 number 3. I'd never read a bunch of Wildstorm stuff before, just the random issue here and there maybe. But this one was fun. Caitlin Fairchild has amnesia, and she thinks she's Supergirl. And just between us, she looks pretty great in the costume. That's actually one of the clues to the mystery, that she has to get a new uniform after every adventure because it keeps getting ripped. Anyway, she's causing a world of trouble, and then things get even crazier when the real Supergirl shows up. Had no expectations for this, and it was a really fun read. I was Joe Crawford. Also recently sent a care package of comics our way. It included a great variety of books, different publishers, different genres, including Dread, Dust 1 and 2. This is a two-issue series that takes place in the universe of the most recent Dread movie. This was put out by the publishers of 2000 AD, and the first noticeable thing about the book is the extreme high quality of the paper, both the cover stock and the interior. Hey, I'm sorry. I noticed these things. The story takes place outside Mega City 1 in the Cursed Earth. Dredd is called to a ruthless gang slaying, which seems to indicate that a standard vigilante is at work, but a residue of dust left behind indicate that this is no ordinary perp. I did some research on my reading history of Dredd, racked my brain, went through all the paperwork and databases, and I think now, with these two comics, I have now read exactly two Judge Dredd comics. Now, I know enough about the character from general comic book and pop culture osmosis, so I knew what was going on, and I was able to follow the story. Solid, futuristic, sci-fi, action, mystery story. Not too shabby. Star Trek 59 and 60, these are from just a few months ago, and this is a pretty cool two-parter. It's a dual story featuring the Enterprise crew of the original series, plus the crew of the J.J. Abrams movies. And the likenesses were, again, pretty good. I always have to comment on that when I'm talking about TV or movie adaptations. Of course, this is both TV and movie adaptations. Throughout both issues, the top halves of the panels tell the story of the TOS crew and the bottom half of the movie crew. The problem they're facing is that both ships, in their separate timelines, have run across a temporal anomaly in the same location in space, and versions of the characters are switching from universe to universe. It starts with Kirk, where Shatner wakes up on Pine's Enterprise and vice versa, and then Nimoy and Quinto switch, etc. And sometimes the character switch lasts for a long time, sometimes they phase back and forth more quickly. It's very nicely done, as the folks on each ship are trying to set things right. And not surprisingly, the two Spocks are the ones that decipher the problem, figure it out, solve it, and both versions of the Enterprise live happily ever after. A very interesting read and sort of a quintessential Star Trek type of story. Scamp 18. This is from 1974, but contains reprints of stories from the late 50s to early 60s. I don't remember reading much Scamp when I was a kid, but I was vaguely familiar with the title, so I must have known somebody who had an issue or two. But they have the Disney connection via Lady and the Tramp, so the stories were on the above-average side of the line, both in terms of the scripting and the art. So even though these were characters I had only passing familiarity with, it wasn't a bad read. Future Quest, number 3. DC has been aggressive the last year or two about turning their Hanna-Barbera properties into comic books. I have heard shockingly good things about the Flintstones book, for example. Scooby-Doo Team-Up is also a highly regarded book. This issue of Future Quest features two stories, one of Birdman and one of the Herculoids. They're sort of origin stories for these characters, telling prequel-type stories from before the team comes together. That's what I'm supposing. Dr. Benton Quest makes an appearance, so you do get a feel for the larger cast of characters that this title has access to and will eventually include. It was a pretty interesting read, and again, surprisingly good. The generous Canadian Rob Lance of the Comic Connection store, Oakville, Ontario, also sent a huge box of comics recently. Like Joe's recent gift, Rob's was incredibly eclectic. Kids books, scary books, old books, new books, including the ones that I read first, because I was a few days away from a doctor's appointment, and I love leaving kids' comics on the magazine rack at doctor's offices. So I started with Sad Sack and Sarge, 6 and 9. These are from the early 70s Harvey comics. For having such a limited premise, which is Sad Sack making life miserable for Sarge on the army base, these ones were surprisingly funny. This is the type of material that I figured would lose some of its oomph as I got older. And it probably did lose some, but not a lot. These stories were surprisingly clever and surprisingly different from one story to the next. And more often than not, they were surprisingly funny. Richie Rich Cash, 24, Richie Rich Jackpots, 24, and Richie Rich Money World, 31. These are more from Harvey Comics. These are from the mid to late 70s. These ones were a lot less consistently strong than the Sad Sacks I just mentioned, or a lot of other kids' comics I've read. There was a sense of telling the same basic story over and over and over again, which, as I said, was a trap that the Sad Sack and Sarge stories managed to avoid. But here you have such a small cast and pretty much a one-gag concept. Maybe I should not have read all three of these in such quick succession. I don't know. Maybe that's what emphasized the really repetitive nature of the stories. I don't know. The highlight of some of these Harvey books were, of course, the Hostess ads, which always featured Harvey characters. Now, that makes sense, but I had no recollection of these ads going beyond the superhero crowd. So we remember the Batman and the Thor and the Spider-Man and the Fantastic Four and Wonder Woman taking on various menaces using Hostess products to save the day. But here we got ones featuring Casper, Hot Stuff, and Wendy the Good Little Witch. It was a really nice change of pace. Yes, I'm talking about the ads. Binky, 81, this is from 1971, when DC still published humor books, although just barely. This is the penultimate issue of what's pretty much a straight-up Archie ripoff series. And it was okay, I suppose, but it definitely lacked the punch of the best and even the mediocrest Archie stories. The one-page gag strips were probably the best part of it, but overall, it was just meh. Captain America 306. This one takes place over in merry old England and features Captains America and Britain fighting the Dark Mage Mordred. The Book of Darkhold was part of the plot, as was the spirit of the magician Merlin. This was the end of an arc, and I'm not sure how many issues before this were in the story. But again, I was brought right up to speed by the middle of the second page, and I totally knew what was going on. Pretty good story, and since Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. on the TV has included the Darkhold this season, this one especially held my interest. All right, time to play a promo here, and when we come back, we'll talk about trades, miniseries, longer runs, and graphic novels.
Trekker Talk, a fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous back streets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at trekkertalk.com.
And we're back. And next up, trades, graphic novels, miniseries, and long runs that I read. Every time I think I'm out of Underworld Unleashed once and for all, I find more. Fortunately, for 25 cents. That helps ease the pain a bit. And last month, I found four more. Batman 525. In this one, Batman goes up against a powered-up Mr. Freeze. He had already accepted Neron's offer before this issue, receiving natural cryokinetic powers and the ability to survive in warmer temperatures. His master plan in this issue is a cryogenic scam in which he promises to freeze the elderly with the promise of reviving them when death or their disease has been solved, except that he will also have them sign over their fortunes to him. Oh, did I mention that this plan was just available to the wealthy elderly? And then, of course, he's going to kill them. When Batman finds out about this plan, he is not happy. Detective 691. I read the next one, 692, that the second part of this two-parter, maybe 6 or 8 months ago. The gist of it is that Spellbinder laments about being a second-tier criminal, never really able to nab the big score. When Neron offers him the deal, he hesitates, and his gun maul, Faye, kills him on the spot and asks Neron if she could accept the offer. In exchange for her soul, she is given visual-based, like, illusion powers, and the issue ends with her getting the upper hand against Batman and Robin, a fight that is concluded next issue, which, like I said, I read earlier in the year, and as I probably said back then, this is Chuck Dixon writing Batman, so it's always going to have a certain level of quality. This issue and the next one, these two Detective Comics issues, may be my favorites of the Underworld Unleashed tie-in stories. Steel 21. I didn't read much of this title, so this issue was pretty meh for me. Mostly it's just Steel fighting a Neron-enhanced Metallo. It's a big slugfest with a little Alpha Centaurian action thrown in at the end. That was my favorite part of the issue, actually. It was standard. It was okay. The character, Steel, is just not my guy. Superboy 22. This one wasn't bad. Most of the issue dealt with an extra enhanced Killer Frost, needing warmth to survive, and so she heads to Hawaii, which makes sense. Drawing all of that warmth to her, she plunges the state into a surprise snowstorm. Superboy and his smoking hot redhead partner, a knockout, eventually are victorious. At the end, Neron offers his deal to Triumph, who rejects it. I like that the story had most of the Superboy cast in it. It managed to seem like both a regular issue of the title, and a solid Underworld Unleashed story. I haven't always gotten both of these things in these stories. When the aforementioned Joe Crawford sent his stack of books recently, he threw in a few Archie digests into the box, pretty much as packing materials to keep the other comics from moving around inside the box. And one of those was B&V Friends Double Digest 246. The great thing about the digests are that you can toss them into your backpack when you're, let's say, flying to your sister's house for Thanksgiving, and read them easily in the airport or on the plane. 200 plus pages of content in a small, easy to pack, not very heavy format. And it was a nice variety pack of stories. A lot of Betty and Veronica, obviously, but there was some variety sprinkled into the digest as well. Some Little Jinx, some Cheryl Blossom stories, and a couple of Josie and the Pussycat stories. And a lot of them, though not all, were Christmas or winter themed in one way or another. So it was a real interesting mishmash of stories. And like I said, a really good travel type of book. If you've listened to this show throughout 2016, you know that I've become a pretty big fan of Archie books, both the old and the new. Some real gems in these stories. And this particular collection was solid. I mentioned Canada's Rob Lance earlier in the episode. The big old stack of comics he sent included Johnny Quest, 4, 8, 14, 17, 19, 20, 21, and 28, from the 1980s Comico run. The books featured a range of artistic teams, including my buddies Mark Wheatley and Mark Hempel, who did the art starting around issue 18 of this. These were the guys who wrote and did the art on Mars number 1, which I covered on Quarterbend 86. They signed that copy of Mars at Baltimore Comic Con for me. And actually, their loose, slightly cartoony style really works for a wild and wacky title like this. Let me go back, because technically speaking, only 6 of these 8 books came in the Rob Lance package, and 2 of them I picked up from the quarter bins at World's Greatest Comics. They had probably been there before, and I'd flipped right past them, because I hadn't really paid attention to Johnny Quest comics before reading the ones from Rob. So I was not in love with Johnny Quest as a kid, although my wife said that she and her twin brother watched it all the time. I mean, it was a show I liked well enough, but it was not appointment viewing for me like, say, Captain Caveman was. But these Johnny Quest issues were good comics. Just about every one was a one-off telling a complete story, usually a really adventurous fun story. These were all total blasts to read. We did time travel, international travel, space travel, just about every type of crazy situation these characters could find themselves in, they pretty much found themselves in. So super enjoyable, super fun reads. Now I know, I have talked about a lot of kiddie books so far in this episode. Well, here's the other side of the coin. The Walking Dead, 139 to 150. It has been 6 or 7 months since I read a trade of this title, so reading 12 issues here gets me a little bit closer to caught up. The action at this point in the series is similar to the action at this point in the TV show, so there is a chance that my comic book spoilers here may in fact turn out to be TV show spoilers down the road, so if you're sensitive to that, skip ahead a couple of minutes. You have been spoiler warned. So, Rick and his crew have discovered the Whisperers, a group whose philosophy is to blend in with the walkers, to literally wear the skin of the dead, to camp outside, to move with the horde, and to some extent control the horde. That is a philosophy very different from Rick's. And of course, Rick can't abide that. You know, Rick often changes his mind about what the right way to live in the zombie apocalypse is. But whatever his current thinking is, he feels the need to correct any group they come in contact with who may have a different approach. So, of course, war with the Whisperers is inevitable. The one little problem now is that Coral has fallen for one of the Whisper Girls, and he asks to join their group, which, guess what, Rick is not all that happy about. And he seeks out some advice from an unlikely source. Because if you remember, after defeating Negan in the comics, they just imprisoned the man instead of pursuing the obvious course of action, which is to kill him. Anyway, things with the girl and the Whisperers don't go great for everyone. Let's just leave it at that for now. I will add that because of the way The Walking Dead is collected, it's actually every 48th issue that's the important one, not every 50th, like a traditional comic. So issue 144 does end with some pretty heart-wrenching stuff. No spoilers, but wow. So, what do you know? Rick's crew finds another group of survivors, and eventually they go to war. That just seems to be Rick's management style. I honestly think we're supposed to be on his side, supposed to think that he's a good leader, a strong leader. But in neither the comics nor the TV show, do I think that Rick Grimes is a competent leader for the situation he's found himself in. The parcel from Iowa's Joe Crawford a few months back included the series Echoes 1 through 5. This is a cool mix of noir and horror, written by Joshua Hale Fialkoff, with art by Rasan Ekedel. There are a lot of names that I just said, and I may have mispronounced almost every one. I'm pretty sure I got Hale right, but other than that, not so sure. I apologize to the creators. Anyway, this is the story of a recently married schizophrenic fella, who's also schizophrenic father, confessed to him on his deathbed that he had spent his life as a very prolific serial killer. Or maybe the son just imagined that. He imagines a lot of things when he's not on his meds. Did he take his meds that day? The story is so good, and the script itself is so good. The black and white art is so good, I don't want to say more about the plot. There is a strong spoiler aspect to the story, but it's about what is reality, what really happened, what didn't happen, so I want to let that part go. I don't want to spoil it. What intrigued me about this series was that the writer, Joshua Hale Fialkoff, wrote the very underrated iVampire series in the New 52, which came out just a few months after this. This series was tough to read because of the subject matter, but it was just so good, so intense, just so well written. And one of the highlights of these issues are one-page text pieces that Fialkoff adds at the end of each issue. There he talks about issues of mental illness, trying to sensitively portray those issues, as well as other interesting topics. All in all, a very solid 5-issue story with a beginning, a middle, and an end. And did I mention that all 5 of these issues of Echoes are signed on the cover by Fialkoff and Ekedel? Because they were. I was Joe Crawford. Heck of a guy. But Echoes was not the only horror-tinged Halloween-y type of story I read in early November, because I also read Joe Frankenstein 1 through 4. I've heard Chuck Dixon interviewed recently on a number of podcasts, usually in relation to other books, but this one often gets weaved into the conversation as one of his better recent efforts. This is from just last year, and is one of the many recent team-ups between Nolan and his one-time Batman artist, compadre, buddy, Graham Nolan. This is the story of Joe Pratt, who is in fact the final heir of the Frankenstein line. The original monster has been his protector in the shadows, a role he has served for centuries now, protecting the descendants of his creator. But when the old doctor's second creation, the bride, discovers the identity of Pratt, the monster has to come out of the shadows to take Joe into hiding. And lots of fighting ensues. And if you're familiar with Chuck Dixon and Graham Nolan, you know that these fight scenes are pretty darn good. I had a blast reading this. The creatures were creative, original, and certainly this take on the Frankenstein characters is different than anything I've run across. The action is great, Nolan's character designs and layouts are dynamic, and of course Dixon's story and plotting are excellent. A very enjoyable read. It's a shame that mainstream comics doesn't want anything to do with Chuck Dixon now, but I'm glad that we're in a world where being blacklisted doesn't cut a creator totally out of the business, that there are multiple alternative outlets for works like this. Mother Russia 1 through 3. This was a Kickstarter book written and illustrated by Jeff McComsey. It's a black and white World War II story. And I know what you're thinking. I've probably read a story like this a million times. Well, there are two distinctive features to this series. The first is that it takes place on the Eastern Front, the Russian Front, Stalingrad. So that's a perspective that we don't always get in terms of World War II stories. And second, there are zombies. That's right. I said zombies. The pitch is simple, and I can see why the Kickstarter met its goal. Stalingrad, 1943. One baby, one rifle, 2 million zombies. In the middle of a zombie apocalypse, a Soviet sniper risks her life to protect something she hasn't seen in a long time, a perfectly healthy baby boy. Mother Russia comes pretty close to living up to that premise, truth be told. It does have the look and feel of an indie book, a lot of silent panels, even some silent pages. And it tells a nice character story of this Soviet girl, a former ballerina, drafted into the military, and now that the zombie apocalypse has begun, spends her time killing the undead. She sees a healthy baby and risks her life to offer some level of protection to the boy. She has to ally herself with a German officer to make sure they all stay safe. There's a resolution to this part of the story, but of course it's a zombie book, so there are always more stories to be told. I don't know if any more are coming down the road, but I would be interested in reading any expansions of this storyline that do happen. Empire of the Wolves, 1 through 4. Now this is a case of a story having a great pitch, a great idea, but the final product just not delivering on that promise, on that premise. The story of ancient Rome is littered with tales of wars and epic battles, but unknown to most, it's a history that reveals the truth of Rome and the empire that followed. An empire of werewolves. Now that sounds great and references the lupine legends of Rome's founding. And there was some interesting stuff between the worshippers of the Roman gods and practitioners of Druid religion. But I just never got a character to care about, and the love story just didn't connect with me either. So some of this may have been my own preference and tastes in terms of monsters. I freely admit that, because for me, at the top of the list are Frankensteins and vampires, and then zombies. Werewolves are further down the list, along with, sorry Ben Avery, muck monsters and mummies. So it may not be that this isn't good, but it is certainly not for me. And I think that's everything. In terms of my favorite reads of the month, some good Walking Dead material, some wild stuff for sure, and the dual storytelling in those Star Trek books was interesting. Joe Frankenstein was good. Mother Russia was really good. And Eclipso versus the Spectre wasn't too shabby either. But the series that stuck with me since I read it is Echoes. And the best issue of that was Echoes number 2, where we learn that the victim we've been following for 2 issues just may in fact be the serial killer. It's a haunting issue of a haunting series. Feel free to let me know what you think of this episode, what you think of any of the books that I mentioned, especially if you've read any of them. You can send that feedback via email, relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or as a comment on the Facebook and blog post for this episode. The blog is at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com. I've mentioned this before. For those of you on Twitter, the Relatively Geeky Network now has its own dedicated Twitter account. So follow us there at relatively_geek. And of course, the network has its own page on Facebook as well. So come join us. And thanks for listening. Keep the pages turning.